Welcome to Why So Weekend, WYSO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Coming up on today's program, 16 years ago, independent producer Joe Richman equipped a group of teenagers with tape recorders to report their own lives. The groundbreaking series, Teenage Diaries, produced some of the most personal and memorable stories heard on NPR and helped pioneer a movement of first-person narratives on public radio. In a new series beginning tomorrow, NPR revisits some of those teenagers, now 16 years older, to see where they are now in life. We've got an interview with Joe Richman and one of the teenage diarists coming up on Why So Weekend. Also, later in the program, reinvention stories. Up first, the weekend news. A new report indicates that in 2012, there were 162 unintentional drug overdose deaths in Montgomery County. That's a record high number, according to officials. And now they're trying to counter that trend with a new ad campaign aimed at vulnerable populations. The findings come from the 2012 Poison Death Review conducted by Wright State University's Boonshoft School of Medicine in collaboration with Montgomery County Coroner's Office. Jim Gross is the health commissioner with Public Health Dayton and Montgomery County. He says the number of overdose deaths have been on the rise since 2010, but the nature of drugs involved has changed. Almost 59% of the overdoses recorded from late 2011 and 2012 involved heroin, and Gross says officials are concerned with those rising numbers, but he also points out that overwhelmingly these deaths occur as a result of mixing drugs that depress the central nervous system, say using heroin on top of a prescription painkiller. The rise of deaths from overdose has prompted Dayton Public Health, the coroner's office, and Wright State University to launch a new ad campaign to help keep the issue in the public eye.
We're trying to reach out to the population. You know, we have some detailed information now that even though the problem is countywide, there are certain areas within our community that the decedents were more densely populated than other places. So we'll be reaching out especially to those locations.
Gross says that in the weeks ahead, some 2,000 posters will be distributed throughout the city and on the city's RTA buses. The commander of the 88th Air Base Wing at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base says federal budget cuts will force a 40% reduction in the budget, but no jobs are expected to be lost. Colonel Cassie Barlow says officials will have to dig deep to find cuts. The Dayton Daily News reports that the base's 13,000 civilian employees are due to receive 14-day furlough notices beginning early next week. Barlow said the unpaid time off work will begin in June. The cuts have led the base to withdraw support for the popular Dayton Air Show for the first time in nearly 4 decades. The quality of air in Dayton received poor marks from the American Lung Association. A recent study ranked the area 24th in the nation for what's called year-round particle pollution. But as WISO's Emily McCord reports, the numbers may be a little misleading.
Particle pollution is a mix of liquid and tiny solid particles in the air that can get trapped in the lungs when you breathe. It can cause health problems, and that's one of the reasons the American Lung Association monitors these things. This year, the Dayton area received failing marks on its particle pollution in the air.
You know, somebody may look at it and say, oh, it's getting worse. Well, it's really not. Standards are changing. They're tightening. They're trying to make things more protective of health.
Brian Huxtable is with the Regional Air Pollution Control Agency. He says the Environmental Protection Agency lowered the threshold for particle pollution. So Dayton earns the distinction even though the problem's improving. And when standards change, tighter regulations follow, which Huxtable says is a good thing because there's only so much a region can do to clean its air since a lot of pollution comes from other places.
And that's why the national measures are so important, because it can address controls on something in another state, because, you know, we want to clean the air that also comes into the area. We don't fully contribute to the quality of our air. It's what's happening downwind of us as well.
But Dayton's air is comparatively worse than a lot of other places in the country. The area sits on the Ohio River Valley, and Huxtable says pollution from nearby coal-fired power plants impacts air quality. And he adds, another measure of air quality, ozone pollution, is getting worse here. Huxtable expects that the EPA will tighten those standards as well, and next year, Dayton will likely continue to rank high on more of these most polluted cities lists. For WYSO, I'm Emily McCord.
Springfield's Rocking Horse Community Health Center has completed a new expansion project. WISO's Wayne Baker reports that the project will allow the center to serve more people and provide more health services to low-income residents in Clark County.
Rocking Horse finished its $7.9 million expansion project recently, which involved adding 42,000 square feet to the health center. With the additional space, there will be more opportunities to provide pediatric, women's, and general health services for families. CEO Dana Engel says Rocking Horse serves a large portion of Clark County, and the expansion project will help the organization handle medical visits, which have doubled in the last 6 years.
Last year, for example, we served about 55,000 visits in the community, and that's comprised of about 15,000 individuals making up those 55,000 visits. So, you know, it's really an obligation on our part to make sure that we can continue to provide those services and to expand.
Engel believes that Rocking Horse is a valuable community resource that gives people access to health care who normally wouldn't be able to afford it. He says the expansion project will help the center continue to carry out its mission.
The real winners in this are going to be our patients, both today and those that we'll serve in the future, because that's what we're here for.
The Rocking Horse Expansion Project was funded by a federal grant, local donors, and the Community Health Foundation. For WISO, I'm Wayne Baker reporting.
The Greene County Combined Health District has reopened its dental clinic. Closed since last July, the clinic now offers dental services 3 days a week for people without insurance or those considered underinsured. Health district officials in Greene County say dental care continues to be one of the most unmet health needs in the nation, and so they're happy to get it back into their list of services offered. The facility will be the only safety net dental clinic operating for Greene County residents. The clinic will offer exams, x-rays, cleanings, extractions, and other basic dental services that usually have a low priority for people who are struggling financially. Sarah Papa with the Combined Health District says they also hope to fill the gap left by other dental care providers.
Most dentists in Greene County either do not accept Medicaid or they'll only accept so many Medicaid patients per year. So that's one of the reasons why we're so excited about reopening our clinic, is because there are so many folks in our county who simply don't have dental insurance and really need this clinic.
The cost of services provided will be on a sliding scale based on income, and if the clinic sees the number of people it saw in early 2012, they'll be serving about 3,000 to 4,000 residents annually. They just need to set those appointments up through the Greene County Combined Health District. In this week's Politics Ohio, Wayne Baker speaks with Laura Bischoff. She's a reporter for the Dayton Daily News who covers the State House in Columbus. Bischoff has reported on possible ethics violations by Republican State Senator Chris Widener. Wayne began by asking her what she's found in her investigation.
Well, you know, we started looking at Chris Widener's business dealings back in December of 2012. We found that he had co-founded the Ohio Equine and Agricultural Association and was a personal backer of a loan. That loan and that fiduciary responsibility relationship, rather, was not disclosed on his ethics statement. And he introduced an amendment to a bill that would allow Clark County to establish a bed tax. The legislation passed, and the bed tax was instituted, and about $400,000 of the bed tax revenue went to Ohio Equine. And then we followed up with a story about how the Ohio Equine had run into some financial problems, in part because they didn't get excused from their property tax. Chris Widener voted on changes to a bill that would allow leaseholders to apply for tax-exempt status. And again, this resulted in another $400,000 plus benefit for Ohio Equine. So that led me to go ahead and look at, you know, where else is there an overlap between his lawmaker duties, his legislative district, and his business dealings. And I came across, you know, the fact that he does a significant amount of local government-funded projects, and one of those was this fire station in Bethel Township in Clark County. And it turns out that in the process of building that, the county building official said that the design didn't meet code, and so Chris Widener took the case to the State Board of Building Appeals. And ethics law says that lawmakers are not permitted to be paid to go before boards or commissions or agencies and represent cases, you know, in proceedings or cases.
Is this the first time that Widener's come under this kind of scrutiny?
Well, you know, he's been in the legislature since December of '99. He took a a two-year break when Merle Kearns beat him in a primary, but then he's conserved consecutively in the legislature for the last 10 years. And to my knowledge, this is the first time that it's come to this.
Now, Republicans are coming to his defense, saying that all this is legitimate and it's been vetted. How do we determine if this is indeed an ethics violation and is, in fact, Widener being looked at by the ethics panel for these alleged transgressions?
Well, it's difficult to figure that out because the Joint Legislative Ethics Commission is sort of a black box. They are not permitted to say what they are investigating or not investigating, and so really you don't know what they're doing until they've done it, come to a conclusion, and maybe referred it to prosecutors. So, you know, we just don't know at this point. Now, Chris Widener says that he has cleared everything with JLEC in the past, but at the same time, if you call JLEC and say, well, what letters did you issue to Chris Widener on a variety of different questions, they're not permitted to disclose that. So, again, it's sort of a black box.
What does Widener say about this? Does he see this as an ethics violation?
He maintains that he resigned from Ohio Equine before he took any legislative action. He maintains that for the Bethel Township, his appearance before the State Board of Building Appeals was that he had already been compensated by Bethel Township and he was there only to answer questions. And so he does not see this as an ethics issue.
What's at stake for him in all of this?
Well, you know, non-disclosure of fiduciary responsibilities and that can be a criminal offense. Non-disclosure came up as an issue for Bob Taft and for, Mark Dan and for a number of other high-profile politicians in the past.
That was Wayne Baker in an interview with Dayton Daily News reporter Laura Bischoff about possible ethics violations surrounding Senator Chris Widener. You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Sixteen years ago, independent producer Joe Richmond handed over tape recorders to some teenagers who had stories to tell. Teenage Diaries was a groundbreaking series that gave NPR listeners some memorable moments and produced some of the earliest first-person narratives on public radio. Beginning on May 6th, NPR's All Things Considered and Radio Diaries will present Teenage Diaries Revisited, a series of new stories from five of the original storytellers. Today, I'm pleased to be speaking with Joe Richmond to talk about the stories that were told 16 years ago and to talk about the new series, and we've got a special guest as well. Joe, thanks for speaking with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
And who's our special guest?
I brought a surprise guest. This is Amanda Brand, who was actually the very first teenage diarist, the first person I did a diary with way back when. And she did a story about essentially sort of coming out to her parents, talking about her sexuality and dealing with her parents who were having a super hard time with it at the time.
Amanda, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Joe, I want to talk about the original concept of handing over the tape recorders to those teenagers 16 years ago. What were you trying to do?
I don't know. You know, partly it was sort of taking advantage of just what is so great about radio, you know, the kind of the intimacy of radio and also the fact that you can just give someone some really cheap equipment and get them to, like, bring it along in their lives. And I think it was also just taking away the middleman, in a way, of the reporter or the host or the or whatever, just to hear directly from someone who's, you know, who's going through whatever they're going through in their lives, kind of, in a way, trying to make ordinary life kind of newsworthy, in a sense.
And what did you take away from that original series? Any surprises for yourself?
Well, actually, just like you say, surprises. I mean, that's what it was. It was like, you know, the act of giving someone a tape recorder, it was like this this like act of faith. You don't know what you're going to get, and it's like going through all those tapes, the hours and hours of tapes, and just finding these moments of gold was addictive in a way. It's like, you know, these are these like real moments that you can find in this, you know, in the dirt here, and you string those together to create some sort of coherent story. And to me, that was just I fell in love with that process, that kind of like behind-the-scenes life, at just behind-the-scenes look at ordinary life.
Well, let's talk about some of the people involved in those first stories, in particular Amanda's story, as you mentioned, at the age of 17. Amanda, who is with us, and one thing, listening to Amanda's story told 16 years ago, Amanda, and you can join us on this, please,
sure,
that at times you seemed really confident and your attitude was strong, and then in the next second in that story you realize that you're just a kid trying to tell a story. Can you speak about your experience?
I am a very confident person. I have to say I am blessed with that. Thank God, because I don't know if I wasn't as confident, then maybe my story would have never gotten through to my parents, or they might still to this day be calling it a phase, or saying if the right man came along, or the right fella, excuse me, came along.
Were you intimidated with what you were doing? I mean, it's a pretty brave thing to be recording your life, knowing where it's going to end up, in the public discourse, and then some of the moments with your parents. I don't know, from the outside looking in, it seems like a hard thing to do, but it wasn't,
yeah,
maybe?
No, it definitely wasn't for me, because I could see where you're saying that from the outside looking in, not knowing my parents. But I wasn't intimidated with the process at all, because I was always – who you hear on that documentary is exactly who I am. I wasn't putting on a show or trying to be more brave than I normally am. That's who I was. But sitting my parents down, they got the picture pretty early, and I was referring to myself as bisexual a lot throughout the piece, because I wanted my mother to feel somewhat – I felt like I had to ease her into the fact that I am a lesbian and not just, bam, punch her in the face with it. I think, my exterior appearance, my personality, my mannerism definitely was, okay, my kid is gay, but I needed to protect her somehow. And sitting down with them, it wasn't at all intimidating. They are the sweetest, kindest people. It was just what needed to be done, and we have grown as, mother daughter, father daughter relationship more because of it. I think, when anybody gets a chance to sit down and just be real with what you are, who you are, to whomever you need to be, I think it just opens things up and it clears the air. So there's no more misconceptions. There's no more what ifs. It just, okay, this is, and now we can move on from there. So I think I'm just blessed to be an outspoken, confident person, and it showed even back 16 years ago.
Okay. Well, this is how I feel, and this is how I'm going to be for the rest of my life. I'm not saying that's how I'm going to be for the rest of my life, and I'm not saying that I'm not going to have sex with a guy. I'm saying that I do. I want to go and have sex with a guy. It's not happened yet.
Well, I hope not.
No, it's not, but I mean, I'm going to. I'm not going to, deny myself of that.
That's what I said. Don't deny yourself of that. And you may find, when you do that, that your whole outlook may change.
It's just not like, oh, this is somebody's decision. They don't really know what they want right now. I've been out with guys while I've been going out with Dawn. Dawn's been out with guys while she's been going out with me. I mean, we're really close. And there's, a love there. More for me towards her than her towards me, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But we're with each other, you know?
Well, maybe that's just a good friendship. You love friends.
Yeah, but I don't do what I do with Dawn with friends. Do you know what I mean? You don't do what you do with Dad with friends, you know?
My parents just think that this is like a phase. Like when, the guys used to get earrings, or when they used to wear ponytails when I was little, that was a phase to them. They think that this is a phase, but I don't think it's a phase. I think this is me. I don't know what to say.
And what reaction did you get from your parents from the finished piece 16 years ago? And then a little bit about the reaction that you got from friends and family.
16 years ago, it was more kind of undercover, in a sense that, not that I wasn't allowed to speak about what I was doing, it just wasn't really discussed. And it was... You know, there was no congratulations, here's a cake, you made a documentary, you know, an audio documentary. It was done, it was put out, and it was, you know, out on the airwaves, and it kind of disappeared. I think, it opened the door for more discussion as to who I am with my parents, so that outcome was fabulous. But it wasn't until about 2 years ago when Joe kind of came knocking on the door again, looking for, you know, people who or participation in his new project, that it really kind of pushed me into having another sit down with my parents and discussing, okay, like, you know, why did you feel this way? What, you know, like, the outcome for me is fantastic because it has solidified a great relationship.
You know, I think with Amanda's story, a lot of the upcoming diaries are really about the diarists themselves. Amanda's story, in a way, is also about her mom, because although in that diary 16 years ago, her mom is having a really hard time with these facts and is saying that it's just a phase and all that sort of stuff. But the fact is, she let you do the story and she put herself in it in a very vulnerable and honest way. And also, she was very supportive of the story after the fact. So there, you know, as I know you would say about your own mom, she was, even though she didn't agree, she was there right in the discussion and right, you know, with your kind of your own grappling with it. Yeah. And I think that comes through in this new sit-down interview that you did with your parents too.
Yeah.
Amanda, do your parents, looking back on that original story and its place in storytelling history, I guess, do they realize that its place and it's an important piece of work?
That's a good question. I wish that they were here to answer that. I don't I'm assuming yes, but I don't really know the answer to that question.
And let's talk a little bit about the update. Joe, you approached Amanda several years ago and some of the other storytellers, and I'm assuming this was due to curiosity. You mentioned that people were always asking, what's become of these teenagers?
Yeah, it's a lot of things. You know, over the years, certainly people have asked about, you know, this diarist or that diarist. You know, part of the series was also inspired by, you know, the 7-Up series that had a big impact on me when I saw it, you know, at a young age. And, you know, even the Teenage Diary series, when it started back then, the idea was we were going to check up on people regularly. You know, it didn't kind of end up that way. We did some second stories with some people, but then just things kind of, you know, went other directions. So it was always kind of in the back of my mind to follow up in some way on the radio. And what really made it happen is one of the diarists, Melissa, who did a story about becoming a teen mom back 16 years ago, had disappeared. From not just from my life, but from a lot of the people that she knew and her friends even. She went through something very tough that is she talks about in her new diary. And she got back in touch with me. I got an email out of the blue 2 years ago and said, I don't know if you remember me, but you did a story about me and my baby and just wanted to let you know we turned out okay. You know, and to be honest, I actually hadn't thought that they were going to turn out okay. And being in touch with Melissa again really got that ball rolling of getting in touch with all the original diarists. And her story is one of them. Her baby is now 16, and she has a second child. She's still a single mom. We did another of the new stories is with Juan, who originally did a story about living as an undocumented Mexican immigrant along the border. And 16 years later, he's got this wonderful American dream life of two cars and a house and kids and a good job and a wife, and except for he's still undocumented. He's still living under the radar all this time later. Frankie, who was a football star at a small town in Alabama, clean-cut, wonderful kid, got in trouble unexpectedly in crystal meth and had a year or two long addiction that he's been dealing with since then. And Josh, who had Tourette's syndrome, did a story about living with Tourette's syndrome 16 years ago, still living with it, of course, but he's put together a life and is trying to live as normal a life as possible with a disease where he can't always control what he says and does.
And so in the presentation of these new stories, again, more surprises for you?
Totally more surprises. I mean, that's the thing. You know, there are surprises just in their lives. You know, I didn't expect to hear from Melissa again. I'd never thought Frankie would have gotten in trouble with drugs. You know, there are those sort of like life just surprises that were surprising to me and I think surprising to them too along the way. You know, you look back on where you are at 16 and you imagine 16 years later and I don't know how many of us would have predicted where we are now. So there are those kind of life surprises. And then just in the process of just, you know, again, like handing someone a tape recorder and just seeing what comes out of that, they're just, you know, bigger moments and smaller moments. And sometimes in these stories, it's just these little things that just like that I fall in love with, a little way someone says something or a little scene that's captured to me, those are sometimes those little things are what makes the stories really kind of click.
And so the process was the same. You handed over tape recorders for the revisit stories. And I want to talk to Amanda about the difference in maybe level of consciousness about what you were doing this time around.
Oh, well, it was definitely more pointed, for sure. The first time around, it was hours and hours of kind of like willy-nilly taping, not sure what direction, Joe would go with the piece. And this time, because of the original piece, it was more directed towards, I wanted to get everybody to hear, and I wanted to hear for myself what my parents, what they thought, and to show their evolution, to show their mentality. So it was definitely more pointed, more directed, with a lot of intention focused on my parents and my relationship to them.
Beginning on May 6th, NPR's All Things Considered and Radio Diaries will present Teenage Diaries Revisited, a series of new stories from five of the original storytellers produced 16 years ago by Joe Richmond. I've been speaking with Joe and one of the diarists, Amanda Brand. Thank you both so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you. It's good to talk.
This week on Reinvention Stories, Brianna Ballard, a Dayton native who's been interested in religion and different forms of spirituality from a young age. Ballard owns Anything Under the Moon, one-stop pagan co-op in the Belmont Business District. She took over the business in March of 2012.
It's a metaphysical shop, basically servicing the needs of the metaphysical or neo-pagan community or New Age community. Energy workers, people who work with crystals, pagans, Wiccans, people in the spiritualist churches, things like that. We want it to be a space of love, a place where people are comfortable and don't feel judged for the purchases they're making, because a lot of people in alternative cultures get judged a lot. We don't want that to happen here, so we try to keep it really homey and comfortable. I've done lots of things in my life, everything from having been a fisherman to a stay-home mom of five. I've been a cheerleading coach, a brownie coach. I've been everything a mom can be. And all of the while, I've been me, which is this spiritual being underneath it all. So it just makes sense that I would be here. My friend Amanda started this business 23 years ago. She couldn't be the owner of the business any longer, her physical sicknesses and things like that. And she gave me the offer. I didn't take great to it because it's a lot of responsibility. It took a lot of thought, and the day that I decided, I've never been so excited. It is fabulous. It's changed my everyday. I think I've grown as a person, and it's definitely feeding me spiritually in a way that nothing I've ever done before aside from being a mother has done. I look forward to the people who are regulars and to the new faces. Some of them become like family. They come in, they hang out, we talk, big, deep metaphysical conversations. Sometimes I see men come into the store in their suits and ties, businessmen. And I often think, oh, are you in the wrong place? And I try to see what it is they're looking for, because I often think they're not in the right place. As it turns out, everybody is looking for an explanation. Everybody's looking for the why. They just want to feel connected. I worry about Dayton. Everyone I ever knew who had a safe, secure future doesn't. The real estate market is upside down. There aren't enough jobs. There's no more unions. There's no more big paying jobs. People are falling apart. People are moving away. I mean, it used to be we were NCR, we were GM, we were Delphi. We're not that anymore. And what Dayton needs to do is find an answer as to who they are. Lots of good things are happening, but I don't know that it's enough to hold the community together. In my life, I have been mainly a mom, a wife, You know, everything that I've done has been under someone else's wing. This is mine. This is me growing from somebody's daughter and somebody's wife and somebody's mother to an actualized person all on my own, to having a voice in the community, to being able to give back. It's a way for me to be creative and spiritual and giving and still get what I need to live on. So it's perfect. I've never been happier about any choice I've ever made.
To see a short film about Brianna Ballard, owner of Anything Under the Moon, visit WYSO.org. This Reinvention Story was produced by Liz Cambron, Julia Reichert, and Sarah Buckingham. Reinvention Stories is brought to you by WYSO and Local Lore, a national initiative produced by AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, Incorporated, in collaboration with ZEGA, with financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. That's it for this week's edition of Why So Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.